Well, it's time for your favorite podcast. Once again, your favorite sporting podcast, your favorite hockey podcast, your favorite all-in-one podcast. And it's amazing whenever I hear that song, and I'm sure you are the same. You end up bopping along as I do, as our guest does. I was just watching him on camera now, and you could see him thoroughly enjoying the song, as we always do. It is the intro to Hockey the Podcast, and 100 episodes down. Thank you very much, everyone, for getting us to that milestone, and some very kind words following the release of that century last week. And yeah, we really, really do appreciate it. But of course, now we move on to the next 100. It's amazing because people say, oh, imagine featuring in the 100th episode. But you could probably look at it, imagine featuring in 101. And that's exactly what's going to happen this time around for our guest. But I'm not going to tell you about him or her. Who knows? Of course, that honor belongs to my illustrious colleague, my superb co-host, my partner in crime, Tyron Jobby Barnard. How are you, Ty?
Jeez, Derek, that is the best introduction you've ever given me. And I feel like I'm going to put that on my CV right there. That's it. Keeping it.
Do it. Yeah. They don't come often.
Yeah, I have my own hired praise singer, Derek Albert. You may know him from places like Super Sports or radio, but here he is, Tyron Barnard's pride praise singer. Derek, you can put that on your CV, praise singer.
Yeah, it's already on. Why do you think I'm recording this?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's been a wonderful week. Obviously, thanks very much to Super Sport for covering the 100th episode, to everybody for jumping on board. But, you know, as we said in the 100th episode, there's so many stories. We've only touched the tip of the iceberg. And, we're excited to kickstart 101 today. And with us is a double South African in both indoor and outdoor, and one of only two men in South African hockey history, I don't know if he even knows this, to have scored a goal at the Olympics and at the Indoor Hockey World Cup. It is none other than Wade Payton. Wade, welcome.
Ty and Derek, thank you much. Thanks so much for the intro. I won't lie, I don't know. After hearing that intro, I don't know if I was more nervous for the rest of this podcast or my matric dance.
Listen, matric dance, not that long ago for you. Derek, do you remember yours?
I
mean, it's a bit
further back. I do remember it. It didn't end well because I had high hopes for my date, and she ended up leaving the event with another guy. So I do remember it, unfortunately, but the older I get, hopefully the less I remember. So probably on my deathbed, I'll forget that I got dropped at my matric dance.
Derek, my story is not that much dissimilar to yours. My date was quite bleak because I didn't want to go to the official after party. I wanted to go to one of those, you know, less peer pressure after parties at one of the Oaks houses. And she was so bleak because she was a year younger and she wanted to go to the real after party. And I was like, nah. And so the whole after party, she didn't really talk to me.
So did you end up going to your one? And
yeah, I went to my one, and she wasn't pleased, so she drank with somebody else. And
So no wonder we co-host the show together. We've increased the matric dance stories. I can imagine that Wade had them banging down the door to ask him for his hand in being a suitor for the matric dance.
My matric dance story is quite bland, Derek and Jubs. I was in a five-year relationship, I think, through school, if I can remember. It was a high school sweetheart, and everything went smoothly and wonderful. Nobody left me at the end of the night, and ended up very well.
A paint by numbers matric dance story.
100%.
That's cool. Well, we all need a little bit of vanilla in the show. Thank you very much for providing it.
Beautiful. I mean, Pates, did you know that stat bomb that I dropped on you there at the start? Did you one of only two players to have scored at the Olympics and the Indoor World Cup?
Jobs, I didn't know. Well, I knew that I'd scored in both. I never saw it as like someone actually kept that stat. but I'm pretty proud. I won't lie. That's flipping epic. Who's the other person?
Have a guess. You have to go a bit further back in time.
An indoor World Cup. I'm probably going to go with one of the Evans brothers.
You would be right with one of the Evans brothers.
Wow.
And I'm going to go with Steve because I think Ian would have been too far back as a defender in the outfield to have scored.
You are correct. Steve Evans. Is the other one. Yeah, there we go.
Wow.
Keep it. So it's just Steve Evans and Wade Payton. And remarkably, both of you played alongside your brothers for the national team.
No ways.
So Mustafa or Diane will definitely join. We don't know.
Oh, yes.
Probably both, but...
yeah, in the next test match.
Yeah. Listen, we've brought it up, so it's not a bad place to start, which is the end of your career was the indoor side. I mean, obviously, you'd had a glittering outdoor career, an incredible outdoor career. You'd been to the World Cups, been to the London Olympics, had the heartbreak of the Brazil, although I know you were in the kind of phase where you were deciding there, and then you switched over to the indoor, and in a very fiercely competitive time, and probably the most rock star time ever to be a national player, you were part of that generation because PSI over those 3 years building up to 2018 really put indoor hockey on the map. And I mean, there are some great photos of all of you getting mobbed by the crowds as you're being announced. It must have been so different from your outdoor, but such a special part of your career.
Yeah, I mean, I've always fancied indoor. I think being born and bred this side of the map in Durban and Maritzburg, we enjoy our hockey down this side and our indoor hockey in particular. And it just, as soon as the outdoor program got quite intense throughout my career, there wasn't really time for indoor. With utmost respect to indoor, because I honestly think it's one of the greatest sports around. It just wasn't enough time to play both. And I say that hitting my head against the computer because I know that Jethro Eustace does it quite well, but that's a topic for another time. But the programs were quite hectic back then with the outdoor side. There was quite a bit of, I don't want to say a lot of money, but there was some money around. So the touring was a lot more regular and there was just obviously no time for the indoor. And then like you mentioned, Jubs, with the with Rio not going ahead, I think that was kind of, I was on the cusp. Had a wonderful girlfriend, was quite soon to propose after that, kind of saw myself settling down. And then obviously with Rio not going down, I just saw such a great opportunity to get stuck in with the indoor for a while because it was just more manageable with camps on the weekend and kind of not taking up any of our week time from a work perspective. And I mean, like you said, it was literally, I honestly felt like a rock star for 3 years or two and a bit years that I was involved. The indoor setup and in particular PSI is just, it's indescribable, hey? And it was such a great way to end my career. I actually haven't retired yet, but it was just a fun way to kind of go out because of the doom and gloom from not being sent to Rio, which obviously any athlete kind of builds yourself up to an Olympics and not going. And then I thought hockey was over. And then I walked into the UCT Indoor Center and it felt like hockey was reborn again. And it was just a magical time with the indoor boys.
And of course, during this time, you played against the international all-stars, talking about 3,000 fans roundabout, if not more, packed halls, the works.
Yeah, it was... I hadn't played much international indoor. I think I only got my first debut, my first cap in at Africa Cup, if I'm not mistaken. I think that was
It's Suckerman, yeah.
Yeah, so that was my first bit of taste of international indoor. Playing, like you said, Derek, playing against those all-stars in Cape Town was unreal. I mean, the quality that Simon and his team had brought out. I mean, Robert Tigers, Mo Fuster, just to name a few, they are the best indoor players in the world. And to have them teamed up, and then as a relatively inexperienced national indoor team to be able to use that as your any kind of preparation, I mean, it just serves you wonders, eh? And yeah, just wonderful to be involved.
Yeah, Robert was actually a guest on our show not too long ago. And yeah, as you mentioned, a veritable who's who of sporting superstars when it comes to hockey. The Dutch, the Germans, the Spanish, the list just goes on and on. And you said you're relatively new to the indoor arena, and it must have been mind-blowing for you to go up against those type of people.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I'd only really measured my indoor skill at IPT over the years, because you could kind of always go to IPT but never really be available for the national indoor team if you were involved with the national outdoor team. It was just the schedules just didn't work, and I don't think the programs really saw eye to eye. So it's just one of those things. So I mean, to come down and then play against, all of a sudden get thrown into the deep end with the quality of that international team was mind-blowing. Yeah, honestly, I thought I must have looked like a headless chicken on the video. Actually, I did look like a headless chicken. I can remember watching that first video and going, oh my gosh, I look like an absolute amateur. And yeah, within a matter of games, you kind of pick up the speed, and yeah, I think just a little bit of experience helps with the adapting at that environment and at that level and at that speed. So yeah, it's just a world-class game, eh?
So, I mean, you obviously then went to the World Cup. So you've been to the World Cup in Berlin, the Indoor Hockey World Cup. It was a tough tournament. We don't have to talk about that. But you've also experienced outdoor World Cups, both in India, and if I'm not incorrect, you also did, yeah, at The Hague in Netherlands. I mean, looking at those World Cup experiences, how does the indoor stack up against the outdoor?
That's a good question. I'm not the biggest fan of traveling to India. I've never have been. India and I did not meet eye to eye at all. It just got me. Delhi barely got me every time. It didn't matter how prepared I was. I always got smacked. But then to go to the outdoor World Cup in India was absolutely phenomenal. I mean, it is one of the highlights of my career, I think, playing against India at the World Cup in India. It was absolutely deafening. We couldn't even hear each other talk. I can remember Clarkie screaming at us, and we were all trying to scream at each other. It was like a 20,000-seater stadium full to capacity. Your hands were shaking. You couldn't even stop the ball. It was absolutely immense. But very different kind of environment to the 2014 World Cup at Den Haag, which I think was the first combined men's and women's World Cup.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
And obviously being in Holland, some call it the home of hockey. I call it the home of hockey. It was an incredible environment. I mean, it was very party kind of atmosphere. The setup, the stores, the common areas, the eating kind of zones at the ground it was like being at like rocking the daisies, except with a massive hockey stadium in the middle of it. That was phenomenal. And then you arrive at an indoor World Cup, and whatever you thought was cool or crazy just gets blown completely out of the window. It was like playing hockey.
I didn't get that. Could you try again?
Oh, that's Siri talking to me. Sorry, guys. it is like playing hockey inside Tiger. It is. Honestly,
I was going to ask Derek about his experiences at Tiger, but he can't remember them that well.
I think you and I had very different experiences at Tiger. If you quote the same thing too.
I mean, for the South African locals who haven't been, I mean, how close did PSR in one of those pack nights? I think of the Mo Fuster series when he was here. you know, how close does that get to the World Cup? Is it just a scale difference? Are they on the way or?
Honestly, it's just a scale difference. I mean, if you could make the indoor venues bigger in South Africa, I really think you could get close to achieving that same look and feel as what they did in Berlin. It's noise. It's just noise the whole time. And even in the game, and they're not playing pumping music while you're playing, obviously, because guys are trying to focus. But it just the people talking to each other in a closed hall environment is loud. And the ball hitting sticks is loud. And the ball hitting the boards is loud. And PSI, it is. It's a replica, obviously just on a smaller scale. I mean, running out of a tunnel with flames shooting out on either sides of you, then the lights going off and announcers announcing your names. And it's the closest a hockey player will feel to a rock star, honestly, at an indoor World Cup and PSI.
And best venue in South Africa for indoor?
Are you asking from a surface perspective?
No, or from an experience perspective.
From an experience perspective, Jabs. I really do like the UCT Hall. I don't know why. I've probably got a sentimental, something sentimental attached to that venue now, because that's kind of where my short-lived indoor career kicked off. And I even when I picture it now, I just picture people standing on top of that bridge walkway. Those stands are packed. They're those UCT pull-out stands on the right side of the court, just packed with kids. I definitely go to that venue. Not my favorite surface, but definitely one of my better venues.
And, you know, we always talk about travel a hell of a lot in the show. And there's no doubt that Berlin stands in my top three as far as cities that I've been to. Absolutely love the place. The history blows my mind in itself, never mind the sheer beauty of it. And of course, then you think back at the atrocities that took place there. And yeah, the list just goes on and on. And, you know, we've been watching the Springboks and the Proteas play cricket and rugby respectively, and they've had to do so of late in the confines of these massive bubbles. So they travel, but they don't get to see anything. Were you able to see a little bit of that wonderful city while you were there?
Yeah, Derek, we were quite fortunate. And I thought the fixture times at the end of World Cup were also absolutely bonkers. I remember we played one of our games, if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong. It was like 10 o'clock. It was either 10 or 11 at night. I don't know who the tournament organizers were, but they obviously were very busy during the day and didn't want us to play in normal human times. Hmm. So we played at these super random late evening games. So we had plenty of time in the day to try and just shoot out and see what we could. We on tour, you are quite limited to the time on your feet, because obviously being due to the nature of the sport, we run around a fair amount. So it's not too wise for us to be trekking the streets of Berlin, but we do, we did have a team historian, Jared Jones, who absolutely loves a visit to anywhere and wherever he could go. So he was obviously leading the charge, and there are a couple of us a little bit older who appreciate a little bit more history, who would also shoot out in a taxi or jump on a bicycle go and see as much as Berlin as we can in the short time that we had, because remember the indoor World Cup is pretty jam-packed. I think two games a day for two games, and then already for 2 days, and then you're already into your cross pools the next 2 days. So yeah, you're in and out. So the time from a tourist perspective wasn't amazing, but we definitely did take some opportunities to get out to Berlin. And like you said, yeah, one of my top three destinations. It was a phenomenal city.
Yeah, really thoroughly enjoyed it. So I'm really glad to see that you managed to experience some of that, as you did many other countries, including London, which a lot of us have, but you got to experience it a little differently, being at the London 2012 Olympics. Now, we've just come off the back of a fanless, kind of soulless Olympic Games over in Tokyo, sadly. But in it, we saw a sensational performance from the SA men's, where they got that famous victory over Germany. Two stars of the show were undoubtedly Mustafa and Dayan Kasim, the two Kasim brothers. Now, you were alongside your brother Tane at London 2012. Firstly, what was the experience like being an Olympian? And secondly, being able to experience that with your brother?
Yeah, I'll answer the second first, if you don't mind. It was obviously my brother and I had got back a long way.
Since birth?
Since birth. we hit a couple of hockey balls in the back garden. I was chatting to somebody about it the other day and how you find connections on the field. And whether anybody likes it or not, a brother will always be able to find his brother on the hockey field. You can ask the Evans brothers, you can ask the Robinsons, you can ask the Wiggets, you can ask Diana Mustafa. There's just the craziest connection. And I don't know what it is. And yeah, my brother and I had that. And it was just amazing playing with him. I think we shared about 60 caps or 70 caps together. Which is absolutely awesome. It also helped my mom and dad because it meant they could just watch one hockey game at one time and see both of us. Because they obviously used to split quite a lot when we were younger playing cricket. The one would go with my brother and one would go with me, and then they'd swap the following weekend. So yeah, it definitely did help them. But yeah, my brother is a flipping lovely oak. And yeah, I wouldn't have wanted to play that many test matches with anyone else but him, because we shared so much time together as lighties, and we saw firsthand when people didn't see us working at training, we were the only ones who really saw each other working behind the scenes. So to see your younger brother achieve something when you knew what he was doing outside of the regular practice times was so, so epic. And I was just so lucky to share that time, in particular the Olympics. I can still remember singing the national anthem against Australia, standing next to him, and we could see my mom and dad in the crowd in London. It was mind-blowing. Still undoubtedly the highlight of my hockey career.
I'm sure. And yeah, it's great to hear about the fact that it certainly is a bit of a sixth sense when playing with the sibling, because you can see it. I mean, we watch Diane and Mustafa play together, and you can't coach that. You can't coach the interplay between the two of them, and you know, they just know exactly where one another is, and yeah, it works to perfection. So let's move to the first question regarding the actual experience in itself. So not just about being there with your brother, but the time you became an official Olympian.
It's hard to describe. The selection is where it all really starts for me. I remember Greg Clark put envelopes in a room and it had your name on it, and you had to go and pick up your envelope and then just kind of take it somewhere else, just in respect of the guys who weren't selected at the time. And then I remember taking my envelope. We were staying in a garden court, if I'm not mistaken, in Bloemfontein. We just had done the hardest running of our entire lives. And yeah, I just remember going out and popping onto the chair near the pool. And I opened up and I saw my name. And I think the letter was addressed to me. And it just said, congratulations on your selection. And then the first person I actually saw after that was my brother, and he was just crying his eyes out, and he just ran up to me. He's like, I'm going to the Olympics. And I was like, me too. Woo. And that's really where it starts, Derek, before you've even got there. Cause you have there's no way to describe what the village is like. It's just mind blowing. The fact that people have built this for 2 weeks of the Olympics and then 2 weeks for the Paralympics. It's just mind blowing here. Everything is there that you need to perform as a world class world-class athlete. I mean, you have a toothache. You go to the Olympic doctor for free. And I mean, that is like South African sportsman dreams. We don't have to pay to go to the dentist. I mean, we all had the shiniest white teeth you've ever seen in your whole life because we were getting our teeth cleaned like every day. yeah, just the gym facilities there, the athletes that you see. I don't know how closely you guys follow football.
Ty loves it. Favorite sport of all time.
Ty and Juan Mata.
Yeah, you bumped into him.
I didn't bump into him. Austin Smith and I were, and a couple guys were in our room before the opening ceremony. And this guy comes walking out and we're sharing the top level of each apartment, shares a veranda. So we have the sharing veranda with, like, we know Team Spain are next to us. And these guys come out and they're like, I mean, they're pretty fit guys. We're like, I don't know what they could do. That was one of our favorite games. Like, great. Kind of guess what the guys do. And this short guy standing on the edge there, and one of the guys pops up like, hey, that guy looks familiar. And I promise you, if you put him on the television right at that moment, we would have all told you it was Juan Mata. But we had no idea. We had to get our phones out. We Googled Juan Mata. And I mean, we were sharing a balcony with Juan Mata for the evening. I mean, we all attacked him for selfies. And I mean, he could hardly speak a word of English. And that was kind of the opening ceremony, the first night of us being there. We were touching and rubbing shoulders with these absolute superstars. And yeah, you're just an amateur. Hey? We're amateurs. We probably paid for like 70% of our tours building up to the Olympics. And then luckily we didn't have to pay anything to get there. And you're standing next to someone who's like, he's netting a couple million, probably a month to kick around a soccer ball. So, I mean, yeah, just seeing the athletes in that, I don't want to say an amateur environment, because a lot of the sports and sportsmen and sportswomen at the games aren't actually paid professionals. I think the US basketball team, and a couple of obviously higher end like runners or athletes are obviously full time, get paid to do whatever they do. But yeah, you almost feel like you're a visitor inside the Olympic Village. When you walk past Venus and Serena Williams, you're like, what am I doing here? Like you want to ask for autographs and you want to ask for photos, but yeah, you almost in the moment have to realize you're an Olympian as well. Like, yes, they earn money and travel the world, but you also travel the world and don't earn money. So you've done all the hard work to get there. And yeah, it's just an absolutely mind-blowing experience. The coolest part was when we were able to allow our parents into the village so we could show them around. So my mom and dad got a tour for my brother and I. Just of what the whole village was about. But yeah, being an Olympian, it's a great thing.
It's an interesting thing you bring up your dad, because your dad was also the head coach of the SA men back post-isolation, back in the early days. But he wasn't the coach when they got to go to Atlanta, so he missed out. If I'm correct, he never got to go to the Olympics as the coach. how special was it then for your dad as a very, very good hockey player himself back for Rhodesia in the days and obviously as a very good coach? It must have also been special to have his boys there to see the back end of the Olympics. And it must be nice that you and Tane were able to give that to him.
Yeah, he's my dad's a phenomenal man. He's undoubtedly the most emotional oak in the entire world. I actually remember bringing him to the village. I don't think he spoke much on our tour. He just wept. He weeps silently. He's not a loud crier, but he just, tears just gently roll out of his eyes whenever he's proud. And flip, for my brother and I to give him that was something special. He was an immense part of both of our careers. The most technical coach I've ever dealt with is my dad. I don't think I'd be able to hit hockey ball if he hadn't showed me. So yeah, to allow him in there, well, not allow him in there, but invite him in there as kind of our guest was phenomenal, eh? And I know he absolutely loved it.
And we speak about your dad as a coach, but that's also where you are catching the attention right now. You've obviously caught it as a player, you've caught it for indoor, but varsity college, you are doing some wonderful things there. We're seeing some great results happening for good old Slytherin. And of course, a final in the USA recently, falling short against SA under 20, against Tux. yes, I said that. But yeah, I mean, so I guess firstly, I mean, the move over from playing to coaching, how did that come about? Was it always in your plans? And how much are you enjoying it before we actually look at your team itself?
Jabs, great question. Wasn't in my plan, not even one bit. We just had our first baby. I was actually still running around on the indoor court of the Riverside Boys, and I arrived at a game and we actually were playing the varsity college boys team, and their coach at the time was Sean Blaker, and he wasn't there. And I asked one of the guys where he was, and Sean wanted to play a bit more hockey, and obviously I don't think it really fits in with what the varsity requires. I think they wanted you kind of full time, no hockey for yourself kind of thing. And I know Bakes is a young old man and still wanted to run around that hockey field. So he stepped down as coach, and the boys actually didn't have anyone as an interim. And I went home that night quite bothered by this, the fact that these young Oaks didn't have anyone. And they're essentially the future of our province, and possibly a couple of national players in the future. And the next day I just went and I got hold of Jody Taylor, who runs the sport. And I said, listen, I don't really know where I'm supposed to be or how I'm supposed to do this, but your guys didn't have a team last night. I don't know if I want to coach them, but can I have a chat? And yeah, I met with Carol Adam, who heads up a sport for varsity college around the country. I think Carol is the coordinator for all the sport from the Cape Town, Joburg, and PE and Durban campuses. And I met with her in Durban, and yeah, she said, listen, hey, if you want the job, you can have the job. I said, like, I haven't done anything. Hey. I have no SAHA level, nothing. No SAHA level one, no SAHA level two. I'm like the most unqualified coach probably in South Africa, which is quite scary, but I am. And she offered me the job and I took it pretty much like 2 days later after seeing these guys. And it's honestly been one of the biggest learning experiences of my life. Hey, it's players often aren't good coaches. This is what I've been told and what I've heard. But I've tried not to relate my playing to my coaching too much. I've kind of just gone full backdoor. I've tried a couple of things. I don't think I'm the most conventional coach, but I've just tried to show these young men that I've been there. I've been whatever they're going through. Well, not everything, but a lot of things they're going through with, like, young relationships, disappointment of selection, struggling to keep up with varsity work, some of them failing. It all happened to me. I did all of that. I was trying to be a professional at an under 21 level. I didn't get selected for the Junior World Cup team. Heartbreak, wanted to quit. So I told my dad I was never playing hockey again. Failed some subjects at university because I couldn't keep up with the training. And so I've kind of approached my responsibilities as a mentor first, because I honestly, I just don't think there's enough support for young men like full stop, whether they're hockey players or rugby players. I just don't think there's enough like genuine support for guys. And that's kind of the approach I've taken with my boys. In the first year, they asked me how soon could I win the league, which was, you know, it made me sweat a little bit in the meeting. And I said to them, I'll win the league in 3 years. And this was the third year, and we won the indoor league and the outdoor league this year. So we did a double header in Durban, which is bonkers. I can't believe it happened. And then, yeah, we went on to dethrone a couple of major varsities at USA, which is also unheard of for our little private campus in Durban North, where I'm only allowed to choose players from the Durban North campus. I can't use anyone from around the country at any other varsity colleges. So, I mean, we are who we are. We don't have dietitians or full-time strength and conditioning coaches or gyms or boarding establishments or reses. We don't have any of that. I have a squad of about 18 Durban boys. Majority of them live with their mom and dads. Some of them train at Virgin Active. Some of them train at Strength Society. We're lucky enough to have Charlo on board. And yeah, I have given the message to my boys that, yeah, I'm there on the side, right behind you. And whatever happens, we face the music when things go badly, and we all have a beer. You don't have to have a beer if you don't want to, but we have a beer if things go well, eh? And that's kind of currently where I'm sitting in my coaching career.
But do you think the impact? It's amazing listening to you speak, and you know, you and I have had many informal chats on the side of a field and stuff, but you know, this mentorship role, how much of an impact has becoming a father made on you in that role?
Oh, it's been huge, Jubs. It's been absolutely huge. I mean, I look at my kids and you're both now. They're incredible. Eh? I mean, as much as they've aged me a little bit, all I hope when I look at my kids, and I know they'll be playing sport one day. I don't think they have much of a choice coming from my family, but I just want coaches to, and whoever coaches them one day, to kind of have the same kind of empathy that I'm trying to show to my boys, and someone just cares about them as a human, more about how incredible their hockey skills or how fit they are, or why can't they do that? Why can't they do this? And just accepting them for kind of who they are, and just telling them that they can be whatever they want to be, with a little bit of support from whoever is their mentor or coach at the time. And I think that's been my biggest driver, is that I want to have an impact on these guys' lives. I mean, I get messages about girlfriends and this thing and that thing, and obviously some of the stuff I don't really have too much time for because I have my own life, but it's exactly when I look back at messages and emails from some of my players and I get frustrated, it's those times when I say to myself, hey, this is exactly where you want to be. And yeah, I have the full trust of my team. And we aren't the best team by any stretch of the imagination, with the utmost respect to my boys. I tell you right now, we are the hardest working team you'll ever see. And if you play against a team that I coach, we will make life very, very hard for you. But I mean, at the USA final, we had, I had six players in my team who played in the second team the week before in Durban, and they beat Gongs 2-1. And now they were playing against, yeah, the mighty Candy Stripes. And I know you had a little subtle dig at Siegs and the Tux boys there, but they're a phenomenal team. Like, it is unreal how good those Oaks are. And I mean, I'm sure we'll be seeing a lot of them at the Junior World Cup at the end of the year. But when we were singing not singing. Normally we sing the national anthem at USA, but this year we did not. But when we were standing up and the boys were standing in a line in front of me, and I was just looking at these guys, I was like, how did we do this? Like it was absolutely mind-blowing. And I haven't cried a lot as a coach. And I think in the semifinals after we beat Marty's, yeah, a couple of guys will listen to this and go, Pates, you're the most emotional like we've ever met in our whole life. But yeah, I just broke down in front of these boys, and it was incredible. Yeah, it's just such a good time, eh? As Robbie Gosset would say, what a time to be alive.
Wade, you know, I mean, you're 3 years into your coaching career, so there's no doubt that you've certainly settled in, and the results speak for themselves. And I remember chatting to Pete Kutsia not too long ago, and I asked the similar question. I remember years ago, I was chatting to a former Protea, and I asked him who was the worst captain that you played under. And I don't want to name names, but the person he said was quite a legend when it comes to cricket in South Africa. And he said it wasn't this person's fault. It was just that he was so talented that he couldn't understand how mere mortals, as he put it, couldn't do what he did. And there's no doubt you were an extremely talented hockey player. Your brother too. You come from a hockey family. There's hockey going through your blood. Was it tough initially being a coach to try and get players to do things that they simply were incapable of doing, which you kind of found easy?
Yeah, great question, Derek. There are a couple of frustrating moments. I won't lie. I often revert back to being coached by Greg Clark. And I mean, Clarkie was the epitome of a world-class player turned coach. Now looking at us mere mortals, trying to teach us a couple of things, probably pulling, I don't think Clarkie had any hair then, but I just always look back to that kind of situation, and you just have to let it go. There's no point in comparing yourself to these guys. We're all in completely different situations. I mean, some of my guys probably were only really playing hockey at like seriously at like 15, 16. And my brother and I were beating each other with a hockey stick at like 3 years old. So everyone comes from completely different environments and situations, and especially at a university level where I've got guys coming from like 6 or 7 different schools. They've been coached by 7 or 8 different coaches from under 13A to under 18A, and so it's too difficult of a task to get everybody onto a level which you think meets kind of your own hockey standard, if that makes any sense. I'm not sure if it does. I just kind of learned to embrace each player for who they are and try and bring out the best in what that individual can be. There are definitely a couple of hair-pulling moments, like I mentioned, because sometimes something might appear super easy for you is actually very difficult for someone else. And I think that's just in life. I know Jabu can do all the things with all the numbers, and I hate accounting and anything to do with that. And that's just the way it is. Some people can just do the things and other people can't. And I'm not angry at Jabu for being a superhuman accounting robot. But yeah, that's what it is.
I'm getting a lot of praise singing. That's also going on the CV. Wade, another thing that's always interested me, and it's actually a little bit of a numbers thing, because it's not a little bit, it is a numbers thing. I love the backstories behind people's shirt numbers, and sometimes there's great stories, sometimes there's not. But you wore number 2 a lot in your career. For example, I always wear number 21. Not because I'm a Jethro Eustace fan, not because Jethro and I actually share a birthday, because I am older than him. But because the first shirt I got when I was a youngster had 21 and I just loved the number, so it stuck. And it used to really hack me off when I went to play in hockey tournaments and you had to be number 1 to 11. So then I'd play in 3 because 21 is 2 and 1, you know, 2 plus 1. But yeah, is there any great story about number 2 other than you were just given it when you were first called up and it stuck?
There unfortunately is not an amazing story to number 2, but is small one. When I kind of first made my debut, or when I was working my way into the squad, trying very, very, very hard to work my way into the squad because the squad at the time was filled with, an unreal era of players, Bruce Jacobs, Ian Simmons, Darren Gallagher, just to name a few in the midfield. So as an 18-year-old coming out of school, Clyde Abrams, sorry, I must mention Clyde, he was unreal. As a youngster coming out of school, you kind of you have these aspirations, but then you look at the national team and you wonder, where the heck am I going to fit in? So when the time came, it was purely a matter of size, and number 2 was a small in that particular kit. I think it was a TK kit, and it was the only one that fit me. And I sure as hell was not going to run onto the field for my debut with a parachute on my back. Obviously looking for the smallest, shortest, tightest fitting shirt that would show off my guns. And it happened to be number 2. And that is why number 2 stuck, eh? And then it just sticks with you.
That's actually one of the best stories we've ever heard. I think that's incredible. I chose a number because, well, it was only one in the shirt that fitted and it just happened to be number 2. Oh, man, I absolutely love that. Oh, man. I know, just wrapping up the show, I know I spoke about Berlin earlier, but you said that, yeah, it would fit into the top 3 for you. What other countries stand high and mighty as to those that you've toured, or even just seen? You don't need to have seen them through hockey, but what countries have you enjoyed visiting?
Number 1, Japan. We went to we landed in Tokyo and took a bus. I didn't see much of Tokyo at all, only from the bus window. I saw a heck of a lot of golf ranges as we were leaving Tokyo. And we went to a little city called Kakamegahara. It was like a little Japanese fishing village. It was unbelievable, Derek. It is the most tranquil place I've ever been to in my whole life. Like, nobody shouts, everyone talks quietly. Not that we understood anyone, but they just were very peaceful and quiet. And I think the place also holds a special place to my heart because that's where we qualified for the Olympics for the second time, in that little fishing village. So yeah, it'll always be one of my favorite destinations. And we got to see a lot of it as well because we had quite a lot of time off on tour. So definitely Japan, Kakamegahara, just special people, hey? Special, special people, the Japanese. Berlin, definitely 3. 2, this is a tough one. I really enjoyed Chile. Oh. I don't know if you've been to South America.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time in South America, and my mom actually grew up in Chile. So,
by the way.
Yeah, I absolutely love Chile. So, yeah, it's a place I've got a lot of history there. It's a phenomenal place.
Yeah, I didn't even know they played hockey until we arrived there for a Four Nations tournament. It was great, eh?
Where were you? Santiago?
We were in Santiago, yeah. Yeah. Mm.
No, it's an amazing place. Really, really cool. My mom grew up in a little town called Iquique. And it's quite built up now, but when she was there, so she's originally from Cape Town, and then her old man got quite a cool job over there, and she, when they moved up, they were the only people staying basically at this massive dune. And there's always those famous images from Dakar, from South America, where you see the cars coming down this massive dune, and that's the one. And yeah, and when I went there 6 or 7 years ago to Iquique, I sent my mom photos and videos back, and she said, no, there's no way this is the same place. It was literally a village with like four houses and a dune, and now it's a bustling metropolis, you know. But, yeah, it is an absolutely wonderful place.
Yeah, it was a great place. We actually had a little, I don't call it an earthquake, because I don't think it was an earthquake, but we were just like all having an afternoon nap one afternoon, and the hotel just started shaking, like TVs like falling off the wall. And you just like all the South African hockey guys, we like in the corridor, we like, what is happening? What is happening? And then someone at the Lungi Tolekele shouted, Gareth Carr was jumping on the bed. We were like,
I actually have a photo of my last time there, because exactly that, you see signs wherever you go, earthquake and tsunami warnings. So yeah, it's very much a regular occurrence over there. But a wonderful place. So you say Japan, number one, Chile is there, and Berlin, Germany is in the mix too.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we went to some crazy places, that a lot that I wasn't too fond of, but I mean, sports, it takes you to some of the best places in the world.
Yeah, it really does.
Look, it's no Lagos, but...
did you ever get to, unfortunately, travel to Bolivia?
No, I did not.
Yeah, no offense to our Bolivian listeners, but if you get a chance to skip it... Look, I always say I'll always visit a place once, always. But Bolivia's once is enough, but I've been there about three times. But yeah, it's not a Chile.
for what?
For Dakar. For Dakar.
So, okay.
Yeah.
But to all 13 Bolivian listeners who know what hockey is, and choose to listen to a South African-based Hockey the Podcast. Well, thank you for tuning in. It was great having you over these past 100 episodes. Hopefully,
and for that 2% in of those 13 that speak English.
And of that 50% of those 13 that actually listen to podcasts. Derek, you've really chased away potentially one listener, and that's it. Our sponsors are gone.
Well, you know what they say, for every Bolivian you lose, you gain 10 Chileans, and that's exactly what's happened this time around.
What's up and Facebook and all of that stuff being done, you should have a fairly quiet evening, Wade, because you're not going to get too many messages from the boys to ask for dating life. I've just realized that I actually still have a 30 SMS bundle on my contract, so I'm sorted. I can communicate. Wade, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a long time coming, but been worth the wait. You're doing magic things. You were always doing magic things on the field. You're still doing magic things with hockey off the field. And, you know, as soon as you get those levels, if you ever plan to do it, I wouldn't be surprised if there are some senior representative roles for you in the coaching sphere.
Yeah, thanks, Chubbs and Derek. It's been flipping such an experience. I've loved it. I always see the podcast, particular take fond of Rhett, whenever I see Rhett's face, or Justin or Lloyd Norris Jones. Obviously, they've been really close mates of mine. Thank you very much for having me. Hopefully the next one, I might be a real coach, talking about real hockey things. And I look forward to it.
It's been absolute honor and a privilege having you on the show, Wade. And I can guarantee it won't be the last time. Thoroughly enjoyed it. And it felt like we could just carry on speaking for an hour, two, 3 hours. Yeah. So we definitely will have a sequel in the not too distant future.
Awesome.
Wade, thank you so much. Have a lovely evening. Have a lovely time at things. And we'll catch up soon.
Thanks, Derek. Thanks, Jabs.
Cheers.
Thanks, Wade. So, Derek, in the previous episode, what we used to do is have a one-question quiz. Of course, we said that's in the past. And instead, how we're going to wrap up every episode now is with the Hockey the Podcast Stat of the Week. Now, I revealed it to you earlier. And you are going to probably insert a really cool sting here.
Stat of the show.
I did reveal this week's stat already, but here it is, the Hockey the Podcast stat of the show. And that is only two players in history, two men in history have scored for South Africa at the Olympic Games and at an Indoor Hockey World Cup. Those two are Wade Payton and Steve Evans. That was your stat of the show.
Love it. And well done, Ty, once again, organizing a superb guest. Absolutely brilliant he was. And I've got no doubt in my mind that he will be returning pretty soon. Thanks for joining us once again for episode 101. We'll be back soon for 102. Cheers.